Howdy, I'm Lauren Fates, and I still have Connie's Tupperware.
And I'm Jamie Sanchez. I'll spend a hard 2,000 woos on eggs. Just eggs.
Are you ready for the beat?
I'm ready for the beat.
Welcome back, all you bounty hunters in the system. There are so many announcements to cover today on the Bebop beat, but the biggest one, the most obvious news drop, is that Cowboy Bebop is canceled. And not in a, like, woke SJW canceled way, just actually canceled. Even though we learned from our Netflix friends that season 2 was at least partially written, people were excited about it. Nope, no more.
There's so many loose ends at the end of episode 10 that part of me was wondering, where do all these things go? And nevermore, we'll never know. I'm kind of sad about it.
Yeah, I'm weirdly sad about it too. I know, like, I was a 6 out of 10 on this show, you're a 5 out of 10, and the fandom is extremely hot cold on the overall reception, but now that they've started telling a story and they've put season 2 on such a cliffhanger, I really just wanted to see what they would do. You know, now that those wings are warmed up, let them fly a little bit more.
Womp womp. There's some conversation in the Facebook groups that are like, oh, maybe they'll auction off all these props and costumes and everything they put time and effort into. And there's another portion of it that's wondering, maybe if we petition hard enough, they'll bring it back. It'll come back like Serenity did for Firefly.
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting thought. Because Netflix itself used to really pride itself as a brand on, we'll renew anything, we're experimental, we listen to the fans. And they revived a lot of shows for reboots or extra seasons that had died. And it just seems like the bigger they get, the more willing they are to say, actually, that's not true anymore. So it's weird that we live in an era that instead of petitioning Netflix to pull network TV hits into its like radius, now we're going to have to petition other streaming services to rescue something from this streaming service. This cyberpunk future is not one that I enjoy.
So on a sadder note, I'm a little heartbroken. My favorite writer, Keiko Nobumoto, passed away on December 1st. We did not know she was suffering from a severe form of cancer for many years. Her last work that she got to publish as an anime creator was Carolyn Tuesday. So I recommend, if you haven't watched that show yet, give it a chance. But in addition to being the screenwriter for Cowboy Bebop, she also wrote one of my favorite movies of all time, Tokyo Godfathers. And it is Christmas. It is time to break out the Tokyo Godfathers for another rewatch.
I hope we have done her justice on this podcast by saying her name frequently and crediting her as one of the geniuses behind our favorite anime. I was so saddened to hear of her passing, and I even remember seeing her as a special thanks on the Netflix show. So we thank her for all she gave us while she was here.
Thank you, Miss Nobumoto. You will be missed.
If you hear some like frogginess or scratchiness in my voice or Jamie's voice, I think it's probably worth calling out that you're not imagining it. We had a lovely time this weekend at C2E2, which is the Chicago Comics and Entertainment Expo. Due to COVID-19 and especially Omicron, I was a little hesitant to go. But Jamie asked me to be on a panel, and not just for the panel, which was great, but I ended up having just the best time getting cosplay photos taken and seeing a lot of friends I hadn't seen in a long time. And frankly, the convention did a great job spacing out the aisles and giving lots of people more room. So yes, there was, I think, a great risk in going, but it felt a lot more respectful and a lot more chill than maybe I feared. Jamie, how did you feel about the panel? Tell us more about it.
I think it was well received, and it was probably one of the more filled panels. It seemed like fewer attendees wanted to go and sit in a room for an hour with people they don't know, but I will say that it was well received. It was very interactive. We discussed live action anime adaptations, and we were kind of jabbing if this was a golden era or an apocalypse. Cowboy Bebop was part of that discussion, but we also covered films such as Speed Racer, Edge of Tomorrow, Ghost in the Shell, Alita, and more. I think overall, the three of us did a great job. Thanks to my friend Bryce for also joining us on the panel. And we represented Anime Chicago very well. It is our goal as a nonprofit to spread education about anime and its production. So we achieved that very well. And I appreciate your time and attention, Lauren, for giving us such a great panel.
Thank you. I appreciate any opportunity to talk about Detective Pikachu, my favorite adaptation. I don't want to spend too much more time with the preamble here. I know we have a lot to get into with Bebop, but I have a toy review for the first time in a long time. At C2E2, I was able to buy a piece of Bebop merch. It is a statue of Ed and Ein. It's really cute. I loved the box. I just think they could have done a little bit better with this figure, so I will post a picture of it on social. The good things about this statue, it's got a real weight to it. It's hefty. It feels like a great display piece, like high quality, at least in its materials. And I like the coloring of it, too. They gave Ed the slightly darker skin that I think is accurate to the animation. Her hair mold is very spiky in anime and well done. And also just the size of Ein. We talk about Ein kind of changing scale in the anime a lot, and he's a big, chonky, accurately sized corgi in this statue. The bad thing is there's just detail work that's missing on this guy. Ein's collar doesn't go all the way around his head. It's just sort of drawn on the front, which looks very strange. The label on the front that says Cowboy Bebop, on mine at least, has been applied crooked, which seems like something they would have quality control over. The statue's also set weirdly into its base. Frankly, Ed's butt is what mounts into the base, and you can tell Ed's butt sort of has almost like a Lego-esque rectangle coming out the bottom that is not fully sunk into the base. It's just a weird construction. And finally, Jamie, this mold of Ed only has 4 toes on each foot.
Oh no!
I had to check because I know, like in classic cartoons, like classic Mickey Mouse type stuff, a lot of cartoons used to only have 4 fingers on each hand. And I was like, oh, that would be very interesting if all along Ed was actually drawn that way. Like, how cartoony, how meta. Ed's not drawn that way. Ed has 5 toes.
I also walked away with some C2E2 swag. My house is full of different screen prints. You know, we kind of artfully arrange them. We go through the process of framing. It's a little bit kind of like a gallery. And so I got to pick up 2 prints from artist Lisa Vieja. They are adorable. One is a kind of homage to the 4 members of our crew, but the last one with Ed also has Ein, and Ein's so fluffy and happy. It's got this really nice little retro 60s vibe going on. And the second print from them, I got a poster that is more vertical. It's of Spike and the swordfish, and he's staring out. You only see his back into this really beautiful purple galaxy expanse. These are both 11 by 17s. But the piece de resistance, as they say, is a screen print from Alexander Icarino. And it is like a multicolored screen print with really high detail. And it looks and feels a lot like the Cowboy Bebop intro. You see all of the graphical text in the background. We get really nice portraits collaged together of all of our main crew members. It's very black and red and with really sharp blues and like vibrant yellows. And I can't wait to frame this. I know exactly where it's going in my house.
I love both of your prints. Jamie showed them off here on our weekly Zoom call. And I am jealous.
It was a good find. Thank you, Alexander.
All right. So I think that about covers what we did this weekend. I am looking forward to one more figure. I really want to pre-order a new Spike and Faye statue that's coming out. It's on the website of Nakama Toys, a local shop that I really love here in Chicago. And this figure, I feel like it's been done before, just like my Swordfish is a re-release, but it hasn't been done in exactly this way. It's called Non-Scale Cowboy Bebop Spike and Faye First Gig Set. And I've seen these before. It's them sort of diving in either direction, firing a gun forward. Spike has a cool trench coat on. Faye has her sunglasses. And behind them is sort of a shattered glass, almost like they're bursting onto a scene somewhere. And I think I've seen these sold separately before in a previous iteration. They sort of click together. And it will be very cool to have them as a set. However, unlike my Ed statue, which was not even $40, this pre-order costs $376. So if I go deep into my wallet and make this happen, I'm expecting them to have all of their toes. This week's episode of the Netflix Cowboy Bebop is called Dark Side Tango. Normally, we get into, like, which episodes were remixed into this one, but I don't feel like many were. I feel like it was just kind of a straightforward take on Black Dog Serenade. Interestingly, though, which we'll get into, I think Black Dog Serenade covers more story, even though the anime gave it less time. What do you think?
I would agree with you on that. It did seem like the show was trying to take its time a little bit between Jet and Fad and establishing their relationship, leaning into it a little bit more than we had seen with previous episodes. But you're right, this is wholesale Black Dog Serenade. And they also have so many beats of the anime covered here too, which I kind of found a little draggy. Like, it dragged on a bit to me. So I guess we'll get into that in a little bit. But knowing how Jet is into bebop music and he knows like the actual names of the artists he enjoys and he can go into detail about how bebop is executed. I really appreciated those kinds of details in this episode because they really gave Jet more of a love of music and his attention towards music as a passion, which explains the name of the ship. I don't feel like we get that with the anime, but again, this little accent mark to make it a little bit more livelier or to help us connect a little bit more with Jet doesn't necessarily mean it was worth a 10-episode blockbuster show that we got.
Yeah, I appreciate that you pointed out the strengthened relationship between Jet and Fad. So a lot of the Udai stuff is cut, and I think that's definitely to this episode's detriment. Overall, Udai is much less menacing. The shadow he casts across the galaxy when he escapes is just much more personal to Jet as opposed to being this known super killer. And I have to ask myself, like, why is it still Udai then? Why does it have to be Udai? Which is a habit this show falls into a lot. That said, what they replace all of that with are these lovely conversations between Jet and Fad. Like, they have conversations where they're like eating ziti and like homemade food in Fad's wife's special Tupperware, and it's adorable. And what that adds is a real like heartstring tug when you realize what a good friend this was to Jet and how sad it is that he's a traitor. I think in the anime, they just went a lot more noir trope, like, uh-oh, the detective's partner is dirty, and they left it just sort of in a, like a template, you know, a noir template. And while that's there, especially in the music of this episode, they gave Fad a lot more heart.
I'm glad you touched on Fad being more of a character in this world and more of a relatable friend to Jet, but I also felt very off about who they cast to portray Fad. In the anime, I felt like he was a little bit more, I don't know, buttoned up and maybe a little bit more portraying the good cop. But in this one, his actor, he just looked a little sloppy and maybe, I don't know, rough around the edges. And I instantly was like, yep, he's the bad guy. Even though I know me, who is the big fan of the anime, already knows Fad's storyline. I kept finding myself being like, well, are they going to play this wholesale what Fad becomes in the anime? And they did, but I was expecting something a little bit more menacing than that.
I mean, I'm all for a grubby Columbo-looking cop. I think that kind of is what they were going for. It doesn't bother me that much. But yeah, the menace is gone from most of the people in this episode, except for the ending, which we'll get to, where fat is made a lot more malicious in a big way. So let's get into it. This episode opens with a flashback, extremely sepia toned, like highly visually affected. And like you were saying, it's the pair talking about music. I didn't feel this scene the first time I watched it. I found myself frustrated that we were sort of doing this long conversation about art that I may or may not care about as a viewer, because I really wanted to see that Udai story, you know? But it's really warmed on me. I've heard a lot of fans talk about this scene like a high point. The two of them talking about jazz and which musician is better with improvisation or better with the technical aspects of playing their instrument. And it gives Jet a lot more character. The reason I appreciate it the most now is that later in this episode, when Jet is trying to talk music with Faye and Spike and they're just not having it, it shows how special and meaningful this partnership was to Jet. This is the only person he connects with in this way. So I do like it. I think it's pretty special.
This scene lends itself well to showing Jet as the detective he once was, as maybe who this black dog is, right? We don't quite know yet why he's given that nickname, but we get the backstory that he's a lieutenant and he's ready to bet hard cash on who this dirty cop is. And that was something that wasn't present in the anime necessarily. Jet wasn't tipped off that there was necessarily a dirty cop hiding underneath. He just was. He was in the background waiting for him to ensnare Jet because he was getting too close to Udai and the syndicate. So they really played up the dirty cop angle, and I'm not certain why. This is one of many questions I have for this episode that don't ever seem to get resolved for me from a storytelling perspective, which actually makes it quite dull in some ways. I enjoyed the texture. I enjoyed this better character look at Jet, but I couldn't quite hook into it maybe the same way you were describing with this first scene.
I personally think they go a lot deeper into the dirty cop thing because it's so much more formative to Jet in this iteration than it even was in the anime. In this iteration, he thinks the dirty cop is Chalmers, and Chalmers is now with his ex-wife. And also, unlike the anime, Jet gets sent to jail, and it's implied that his 5 years in jail are kind of what lost him everything. We see him in this scene name his daughter Kimmy, and I think at this point his marriage is relatively stable. So this is when it breaks bad on him and changes his life forever. This Jet has, I think, a lot of hidden resentment toward what happened in this episode and what it took away from him. Even though he's at peace having this prosthetic arm, he's not necessarily at peace with like Chalmers still being around, especially when he thinks Chalmers did this.
I agree with all that, but I also don't believe that Jet as a character in the anime needed any of this story. I think it told his story very poignantly, very quickly. He still has that resentment. The definitive portion between the anime and the live action is that they took Jet's agency away from this. In the anime, Jet was living in a life of his own design. These things happened to him because he made choices that he made. Whereas the live action almost said, Jet's too good of a guy. He couldn't possibly be flawed in these ways. Clearly something needs to happen to him to upend everything he worked for when he proved he was a good cop.
Oh yeah, I don't agree that these were necessarily good or needed choices. I loved Jet's story in the anime, and not to put too fine a point on it, but this series frankly took its black lead character and made him both an absentee father and a man who did jail time when maybe neither thing was necessary. And that's a little chilling. I don't love it.
And that perspective colors my view this entire episode. Which is maybe why I don't connect with it as much as other fans have. We transition from the conversation in the car into the chase scene for Udai. Both Fad and Jet are walking down the hallway. We get a lot of Dutch angles up the stairs and as they kind of stalk the hallway to Udai's apartment. I already want to punch Fad in the face when they're talking about Kimmy's name. I don't know why. Maybe it's just the delivery. But it's nice to see Jet at work and doing the thing he does best, right? Tracking down someone. He's on the prowl. And I thought the chase to the alley once Udai escaped down the fire escape was looked actually really great. You know, this mid-sight set was convincing to me. I really enjoyed the aerial shot, the technical aspects of getting this to feel very energetic and vibrant while still maintaining its demure, like noir feel, really executed very well.
And you are right. They go noir so hard throughout this entire thing. There is a song that repeats throughout this episode whenever we're in this world with Fad, the sepia-toned noir world. And I don't know the title of it. I'm going to have to find it. But I swear it's inspired by the theme from Donkey Kong Country. You know that song that goes, ba-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I couldn't stop hearing it. It's over and over, but like a noir version of Donkey Kong. That made this episode fun, I think, unintentionally. Something that was intentionally really fun for me this time was trying to spot when Fad is lying. And I think it's always. In this chase scene, Fad supposedly gets shot by Udai, and then he's like, go, go, get him. I don't think he gets shot at all. I think he's a fakey fake faker. And even later in the episode, when supposedly his wife calls and he's like, hey, baby, I'm here with Jet. I don't think that's his wife on his phone. What a freaking liar.
I'd agree with you on those observations. But I also think that it's Jet's rose-colored glasses for Fad, his relationship with Fad, that really puts him into this situation. He can't doubt him for some reason. And it just obviously he's going to get super fucked here. So we do get the scene where Jet loses his arm, right? And it's actually very gruesome. I appreciated the production's team effort to make this both realistic, but also drive home the point that, okay, this arm is done for. It's shot up. But I would have appreciated more the big artillery. I think that was more convincing in the anime for me.
Yeah, I agree. He definitely very specifically takes all of the bullets right to the arm and shoulder. And so you go, well, that arm's gotta go, I can tell. But in the anime, I felt like his whole person was in grave danger. Like he might have just been killed. The live action didn't scare me for Jet's safety in the same way. I wasn't like, oh man, this could have been the end for him. It just tied much more directly into the arm.
So this shot that we get leads into a cut of the bebop, where Jet is tightening the screws and talking about music. And I felt like this was a very good transition and one I wish that the show would leverage more throughout this kind of dynamic or mirroring of two situations to tell the story and thread the needle. We see that Ayn and Faye are both checked out. They don't give a shit about Bebop. But we do get Spike walking in half-clothed, yes, please, and complaining that the shower is cold. And I absolutely love that they decided, yes, we have to also make the shower really shitty, but also Faye needs to be the problem. It felt very Bebop to me. I felt like we were at home with them finally.
Yeah, I've seen the shower bath shower thing take a lot of grief online, and I just don't know why. This Faye, like, filing her nails and preening and talking about all the water she wastes, it's absolutely true to the anime. I think it's spot on.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. We get into shower, bath, shower, but we also get into loofahs. Maybe anime Faye didn't get that specific about things, but she definitely was all about aesthetic and cleansing and rituals and preening, as you said. They're on the mark here.
So Big Shot comes on, they run over hearing the theme song, and I swear they must have recorded so much Big Shot for this episode because not only do we see a lot, but it's going on in the background even when the camera and our eyes as the viewer aren't focused on it. We hear there has been a prison escape, there's gonna be a turkey shoot, all of these bounties are being chased by all of these bounty hunters. And this is where we get a lot of those Easter eggs. And the ones that I'm just not sure if they're supposed to be nods to the fans or if they were meant to be things that came around in season two. We see Earl Terpsichore. We see Cowboy Andy. I just wondered if they were supposed to be there in the next season. But now we know there's never going to be that. We're never going to know. Pour one out. Pour out a kudo.
Also, hi, Kim. We finally see you as the Sutherland twins. This was great. I'm glad I got a second look at this because well done.
Yeah, a lot of these bounties are really funny. We also see Bitch Cassidy on the board, who was referenced by our friend Naomi. Just a lot of cuteness going on. What's not cute is just how grim it is throughout this episode as bounty hunters are literally murdered. Punch and Judy just like take their names off of this Price is Right ass looking board and just dump them into a hole. Like, goodbye, you're garbage.
So this entire subplot to the episode is definitely for the Spike and Faye shippers. I can't stress that enough, right? We have the opportunity for the two of them to pair up and they don't want to. Specifically, Spike doesn't really believe that Faye is the bounty hunter that she says she is. And it's a juicy episode. This was the part of the show that I wanted more of.
Yeah, lots and lots of Spike and Faye food. I'll get on that in a second. I just want to gripe for a moment, as I am wont to do, though, about the Easter eggs in here that I cannot see, like physically can't see. Spike comes into the room wearing this robe, and the robe has embroidery on it that says E-A-R-L-E, Earl or Early, and there's a word under it. And I have a pretty big TV. I paused my TV. I got really close to it. And the texture of the robe keeps that smaller embroidery from being seen. And similarly, there are pots and pans hanging over them on the Bebop. And one of the pans is like directly centered, directly facing camera, clearly very intentional. But because the focus is on Spike and Faye, I can't read what they put on that pan. And I'm starting to get very frustrated. Like, how much time did you guys put into like references, references, references? And then they didn't even get shown. I think I'm just mourning the fact that there wasn't going to be a season two anymore. And like, did you guys put a lot of your resources into Easter eggs instead of something else, something better, like writing? Oh no, oh God, I'm spiraling.
I'm still irked by the fact that it only takes 20 minutes to get to Europa. Just like later, it only takes 11 minutes to get to Earth from Mars. And I'm like, how? Why did you compress these times like this? It doesn't make any sense to me to pop off to world. Part of the journey of Bebop was how much time they had to spend together not doing anything. And I imagine that doesn't make for riveting television. But at the same time, that's when we get this like weird ennui or like this sense that, you know, time is just passing them while they live in the present without any real purpose or harmony in their lives.
I agree 100%. I feel like we talked about this a bit in our Reddit episode on Discord, but that quiet boredom is just missing. And this episode actually seems to resent the quiet boredom. Like, we're not going to spend any time in it. We got to go.
Yeah, and I'm not feeling that. I think that's the one aspect of Cowboy Bebop, the anime, that really draws me to it over other anime or other storytelling. Give me the purgatory. Give me their boredom. That's what I enjoy.
I do recommend fans at home turn the subtitles on if they're watching this on Netflix. There is a moment as Spike and Faye are sort of standing together, frustrated that they have to team up. And in the background, Punch and Judy say, "The universal cuff, keeping bounties and cowboys together across the universe." And it's just so literal. It's like, these two are stuck together. And I never would have caught that if the subtitles weren't on, being like, now's the time when you should listen to the background noise.
I didn't catch that.
So Jet goes to an evidence box he keeps, and inside are some of his personal things. They're not just stuff related to the ISSP, because there's a trophy in here. I can't tell what kind of trophy it is, if it's baseball or golf, because the bottom of it is, I think, intentionally obscured. But this is his cute little special things box, And in his special things box is information about Udai and this case that has previously gone cold, but now is creeping back into his life.
It leads into a reunion with Fad, which feels just like the anime. We're using a lot of orange colorization here, which, I mean, that's kind of the overall tone of the show is heavy color filter. But overall, I feel like this interaction is true to what we see in the anime. We talk about the mention of white tigers, which is the first nod in this live action to other syndicates other than the Red Dragon. But we also get this ancient car of his that I imagine runs on fuel. And if it's supposed to be the future, how is this car here? Did he get it from Earth? Is he rich? Can he export it? Can he drive it around? Does it run on wishes? Lauren, I need to know.
The thing about this car that drives me crazy and being the person who pauses and looks for details all the time is absolutely my curse when it comes to this show. This car, when it pulls onto the set, has a license plate that says 357 Mag. That's a funny through line. Remember how I said the other cops had a different like license plate that just said gun? This is also just a license plate that is a type of gun. So all the ISSP people are driving around with gun license plates. But later, in a later scene, we see his back license plate on the exact same car, I think. And it's not the same. It's a different license plate. I will say, though, just to give credit where credit is due, one thing this show is doing right for me is Jet's like weird desire to keep re-triggering himself. Like, who keeps all of these old newspaper clippings about the worst time of his life just to like look at and gaze at? The courtroom drawings of himself about to be sent to jail. God, Jet, even his old suit that he wears to this scene to see Fad, man, you gotta let some of this stuff go or you're just gonna be haunted forever.
Anime Jet does that too. And again, I'd recommend space therapy. So this interaction between Jet and Fad leads them to discuss like, okay, Chalmers put Jet away. Why does he think that? We start asking questions about what is the nature of this dirty cop? How did Jet earn his good cop reputation? And well, now I'm just confused. Like, why even insert all of this stuff? It could have been as simple as, you know, I was forcibly retired because my arm was disintegrated and I could no longer work cases. But instead, we have him doing time and we have this kind of rehash of him living old bad memories of his life. He's just bitter. And I don't know. It hangs on him in a way that looks unfavorably, whereas I feel like Anime Jet carried it with more purpose because he has that iron code of honor.
Thank goodness for the editing of this episode, bringing us back to Spike and Faye over and over, because all of that melodrama and sadness about Jet, it really does need to be balanced out with something. And Spike's line, "I like my face and so do many others," is one of my favorite lines in the entire series. The way he delivers it with the emphasis on many, he's like, "I get so much action. People love me. I'm a babe. I know it." And it's just this continued coloring of Spike. I'm thinking back to the like dominatrix scene, for example. This Spike gets it all the time and wants to tell you about it.
But then we also pepper in scenes of Vicious and Julia, and they're discussing their continued plot from the previous episode. They get one shot at Mao, so to speak, to convince her that she should join their side and kill the elders. And we get a line from Vicious where he goes, "I'll kill that bitch with kindness." And I did not know whether to cry or laugh hysterically. I think I did both.
Well, he does that to concede to Julia. He's saying, "Okay, dear, we'll do things your way." And this is a more interesting part of doing a watch through now, because now that we know where Julia ends up, I'm just desperate to see if there were any hints. And I guess this scene does count. The first time I watched it, not knowing the ending, Julia's like, "Don't go in and murder everybody. You could negotiate with Mao. You could do like a truce and a interpersonal betrayal. This like puppet stringy stuff." I thought she was just trying to keep herself safe and like tone down Vicious's bloodthirst. But they cut to her face a couple of times in a way that I think does imply she actually wants control and she actually is thinking about a power grab in the syndicate. I don't know if I would say it's well done because I really had to pay attention to look for it. This foreshadowing is not super strong, but it's there. They tried.
I would agree with you that the first time through, I was hoping that she was trying to keep herself safe, particularly from the one elder who wanted to kill her, right? But at the same time, we know she's in an abusive relationship, and we know that Vicious has done this in the past as well. You would think she'd just try to get away from him, period. And this is where things just didn't sit well with me. I remember the first time through looking at this kind of sideways, wondering, what are they trying to do here? And you're right, now that we know how it ends, I still don't think that was a good choice, though. This scene really interrupts the flow of what's going on with Fad, what's going on between Faye and Spike. The show would have been better served if Vicious and Julia's story was maybe more self-contained to two or three episodes.
I agree. That said, if I were to cosplay Julia from this series, I think this would be the outfit. I really like her slinky green jumpsuit. She wears this giant necklace all the time, too, that I really thought was going to become something. Like, you know how Gren in the anime has a music box and the music box is actually sinister and it's a tracking device? I thought we were going to find something like that out about Julia's huge necklace that she rocks all the time. But it's nothing. It becomes nothing.
Moving on, we get this cute scene between Faye and Spike where they're trying to choose a bounty. They still can't do it. And now she's making shit up about rock, paper, scissors. I feel like we did that in our teenage years. And it was all the rage to come up with new rock, paper, scissors games all the time.
The Big Bang Theory already did this joke, though. Like, it's an extremely famous bit from The Big Bang Theory. And so, I don't know. I was not a fan.
As someone who did not watch that show and kept far away from it, this was new to me. But at the same time, I was wondering, why is Faye doing this stuff? What kind of person is this Faye where she would be making shit up about it versus trying to manipulate or scam Spike out of something like she would in the anime?
Spike in this scene, however, feels pretty anime accurate to me. I just loved when he said, you always pick the third choice, even though she was trying to run this very crappy scam on him. He was able to catch her pattern right away. And I like that it gives us that taste of how observant and smart he is.
I appreciated that. In addition to the next scene, this was an addition that we didn't get in the anime about Jet and Fad going to an opium den to track down Udai. We see the person at the counter reading a book entitled Jamming with Edward. She's trying to sell off secondhand hookahs, which sounds disgusting. And we also learned that Jet did not just 5 years at any prison. He was at Pluto Supermax, which is the prison we get to learn about in the anime and in the manga.
I really actually appreciate how this set is dressed. There are lots of posters and lots of graffiti, which was very true to the anime. There was always stuff written on the walls or glued to the set. There is a poster that says Tears Redder Than Blood, which is obviously like a poster about Red Eye, I guess. Okay. Other posters include Bondage and Discipline, Revolt, Strip Club, Girls Night Out, Embroidery, Life of Bi, and The Name of the Wind, which is a real actual popular fantasy book. I guess that's a reference.
So the duo's here to essentially torture Dagmar to giving up Udai and his new identity. I thought this scene where Jet takes out his fake teeth and starts pulling them out individually, and they're worth 90K a pop, was a fun interpretation of actually torturing a man. They didn't show us this. It was all emotional torture. And I'm like, yes, Jet would do this.
This was really funny to me specifically because I am dentophobic. In fact, I'm not only phobic about teeth, but also nails. All of that stuff weirds me out. I can't stand a scene where anything is happening to teeth or nails. And when they did it with dentures instead, I was like, oh, weird. My fight or flight isn't turning on. They found a way to get around that for me. And I actually like smiled. It was successful.
I'm glad we both enjoyed this very specific scene.
Udai is given a new name by this guy. He doesn't actually get to pick the papers up, which is a great bit of sort of detective assertion on the part of Jet. It prevents Udai from leaving town. But Udai's new name is Navajas Trejo, and he is a Sarissian teacher. And I just thought that was funny that they made his fake profession teacher, because Udai is such a terrifying looking guy. Like, imagine Udai getting up in front of your class and being like, "Today we're learning Sokochoa. Get ready for math."
I just thought Danny Trejo. I don't know why. This guy gives me Danny Trejo vibes.
That might be the intention. Back on the Bebop, Spike and Faye are still going at it, and I say that in a very saucy way. They're drinking FNTN beer, Bubbles for Our Troubles, and they go into this scar-sharing, like, penis battle about who has the biggest, gnarliest scar. Spike's never heard of Faye, and the opening riffs from Don't Bother None come on, and they literally start like lifting up their shirts and showing each other these wounds. And folks, this is a sex scene. I don't care what you have to say.
I mean, you get the sound of Spike unzipping his pants.
Like, I get that it's not a literal sex scene. We don't fade to black. They don't actually bone. But I think in this format for like this rating, this is about as close as it can get. I got a fanfic to write. BRB.
We learned that one of the bounties is Tony the Chop, and I can't figure out if it's a reference to One Piece for Tony Chopper or a Guy Ritchie film. It could go either way, to be honest.
I'm just dying over how much this podcast has become about discerning references. Like, what is that? What does that mean? Every 25 seconds of this show.
Spike also mentions the word souvenir, magic word, right? And he gets the souvenir from Joey T, or I thought maybe he said Joey Teeth, and the other scar he has from Regina Scissors. So it's a very literal thing here. One man chops, the other man has teeth, and the other woman has scissors.
Yeah, they name their criminals very on the nose in this world. We cut to Mao, and I was very surprised by this take on Mao. Not the part where she's a woman, like, that's fine, that's great, I'm excited by that. But they appear to be making gold bars, and she's just straight up doing this, like, blacksmithing, like, in a kiln, in fire. And I'm just not sure that I am behind, like, the crime boss, the leader of this family, being like, I do the labor. I guess it's nice that she gets her hands dirty. I don't know. I just think this was a weird place to find this person.
I'm with you there. Why is a Red Dragon capo smelting? It didn't make much sense to me. I thought overall the rework of Mao was kind of dumb, to be frank, fully dumb. I think Mao should have maybe been the capo in episode 9, who we'll get to later. There really was no need to name this character Mao, since she doesn't embody or retain any of the actual characteristics of anime Mao. And I found this to be one of my major sticking points for the show.
Just to put a pin in it and declare, like, I think I understand this. We have Vicious, Mao, and Santiago the Eunuch. And they name the different families, like, these are the tigers, these are the dragons. But I think in this interpretation, these are families within one syndicate. It's still one, but they're not rivals. They're not like necessarily fighting each other for territory in the same way. They each have territories. They each have businesses that are theirs, but laddering up to the same elders.
Correct. Yes, that was my interpretation as well. But what I didn't understand were who were Coben's blades. We find that out later when we see a fight with them. But why does Santiago exist? Why does Cowboy Bebop need a villain more terrifying than Vicious? Why make that distinction? Why create this person?
Yeah, the Santiago imagery is campy violent. They say he cuts off people's balls with the same knife used on grapes at like vineyards. And they keep showing these cuts of like vines and vineyard stuff, just getting splashed with blood. And this man literally says, "You'll never know true power until you've tasted the testicles of a man who has wronged you." I don't really get this. I don't really see the need for it. But I actually ran into former podcast guest Travis yesterday, and we talked about this. And he says this reminds him of Tarantino films. And the fact that the fandom would come down so hard on, like, this is cringy, this is cheesy. Some of those people are probably the same folks who think Tarantino throwing blood everywhere and like tossing out these weird violent lines is very cool.
I don't think that's Bebop, though. You can argue either way, I suppose, but like, Vicious should have been the terrifying one. And this show chooses to make him more relatable, still give him a bloodthirst and just fly off the handle, but I don't think it's to its benefit.
Vicious gets one line that I considered pretty terrifying, pretty clever, and it's when Mao is saying the reasons they can't kill the elders, and Vicious goes, "But it sounds like you thought about it." And he's right. That's a good line. It's too bad that this scene for me just goes south so completely when Mao's like, "I want Julia to sing for me." Julia sings in this moment. I think it's the first time we hear the vocals to Julia's song. And man, it doesn't pay off over time like I want it to. If Julia is this vocalist who is so high value and so talented that syndicate bosses will change like major coup level decisions just to hear her, why does she only have one song she does ever throughout this whole season over and over? And frankly, why is her voice a little pitchy in this moment? I'm so sorry. She sings a little bit off key and I'm like, oh no.
I can see the literal gears turning in the writer's room, kind of, when they're like, oh, well, Vicious doesn't want her to sing and she shouldn't sing in order to make this deal happen because it proves that Vicious isn't in control. And the tension there they create is interesting and palpable. But again, I don't think it's Bebop. I don't know why the scene exists. I do appreciate the one line from Vicious where it seems like he's being strategic, or he's a little bit more perceptive than we see throughout the whole live action. But why does it just have to be relegated to this one moment?
Bless it, though. One of my favorite scenes in the whole show is the next, and that is Faye talking about how she took down her biggest bounty. And we cut back and forth between her tangoing with Ayn and tangoing in the past with this man she is disarming and about to punch in the face and take in. We know that the corgi she's dancing with is Charlie. Charlie, you're listening. You're such a good boy.
Such a good boy. Bestest boy.
And I think I can actually tell the difference now between Charlie and Harry. That may be crazy, but there's a moment earlier in the episode where the corgi is just a little fluffier. And I'm like, I think that was Harry. And in this moment, it's Charlie. And that's a weird thing to start to notice in myself.
Also, props to Daniela Pineda for building those guns to carry around a 30-pound corgi. They're not really light at all. That's going to be a lot of work. And for what, the hours of shooting to nail this scene? Props. Thank you.
I also find something extremely charming in the fact that Spike is like, "You have my respect, unadulterated respect." And once they reach that point, they just get drunk and they just drink all the beer and eat all the snacks on the ship instead of going out and getting a bounty.
In much the same way we described the Bebop in episode one as a bachelor pad, I would describe this relationship as like college bros. It felt like that moment to me where they just still haven't grown up and, you know, become true adults, but now they're completely respectful of each other, and that means they must drink.
And this is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. I think Spike just hanging out at home and getting drunk, even when they really need the money, I think that's true to the anime. A lot of people, I think, over the last 20 years have crystallized this image of Spike as this like cool, competent, gun-toting, smart fighter and bounty hunter. But Spike's actually like kind of bad at his job in the anime. because he has such a hard time like getting motivated and just committing himself to go out and do it. Obviously, once he engages, once he's on task, he's killer, but he's not like that all the time. Sometimes I truly agree that he would just hang out and throw back some cold ones with Faye. And if you think otherwise, I think maybe you should rewatch the anime with an open mind.
So we finished this episode at the sorting station, the place that Fad and Jet believe Udai is hanging out in because he's trying to get off world. He's going to stow away into one of these interplanetary container freighters. And two things strike me here. One, the show actively made the choice to divorce the Udai-Jet fight scene from the awesome space battle we get in Black Dog Serenade. And that is a huge detriment to the story, I believe. I do think shipping container scenes, you know, they're kind of on budget. They do let you ground some things. You don't have to do a lot of CG to make this look decent, but it's not the energy of all of these prisoners floating out of space and having a big giant space battle. That's what I want. Give me the space battle. But point number two, these container freighters aren't what we see in Heavy Metal Queen. I thought the assumption was that all freighters had triangular containers, and that is not the case here. It is very real world to today. They're boring. They're boring to me.
Correct. And we already saw one of those triangular freighters in the Teddy Bomber episode. So we know they exist. And it's weird that both are now happening. You're right, though. These are real. And I know that they're real because I paused the screen when I saw a logo on one of the trucks. And that logo is Royal Wolf. And I just imagined, oh, this was another thing that the in-house graphic designer made. This is just an in-world company. No, it's a real company. Royal Wolf is a real shipping container company with an Australian web address, which makes sense because they were over in New Zealand. And so they're in a shipyard full of containers that are like obviously props from a local New Zealand company. I don't love that. I just love that I found it.
There are some really great scenes here, I think. The cinematography did some really good, interesting choices, such as a shot below Jet's face looking up and his brimmed hat is illuminated by the light behind him. Some of the cutscenes for the action as he's like parkouring through the containers, I felt were really energetic. They were very quick compared to maybe the earlier action in this series. So all of it did culminate to the Jet Fad interaction I was hoping for. I just still think that the space battle scene is a better executed story. There's more fear and intent in that. Udai's malice really seeps through. And then the reveal of Jet getting played by Fad is probably more potent to me in the anime. There was one minor thing in this scene. They CG'd a drone in that lifted up containers and moved them elsewhere. And so I do think that when we were complaining about mid-level sets not having that space-like detail, this was one thing they managed to fit in that made this little sorting station thing feel a little bit more futuristic.
For sure, for sure. I caught a look of that too, and I think it was especially successful when they did sort of an overhead shot looking down at Jet from the sky, and then closer to our eye, we could see that drone flying through. Because absolutely, without that drone, this is one of those black background nothing sets, and this was a decent attempt. There is a big change from the anime in how this episode wraps up. Fad emerges from the darkness, having killed Udai. And just like the anime, we know it's about to go down between Fad and Jet. But this time, Fad absolutely shoots at Jet. Jet deflects the bullet with his arm, which is very much like kind of a heavy-handed, the trauma of your past sucks, but look how it saved you in this moment. And then Jet shoots back and kills him. And if I recall correctly, Fad didn't bring enough bullets in the anime to successfully kill Jet. He didn't intend to. He wasn't going to. He just wanted to, like, draw Jet into shooting him. It was, in its own way, almost like a suicide. Like, I'm gonna pull aggro and die here. I don't think Fad had any guilt or any intention of dying in this one.
Not at all, no. It upset me in the same way that Faye was the one to kill Asimov in the live action and not Katarina's decision. I think Bebop really shines when we have these moments of like ethical consideration or worry or just this nuance for I'm tired of life. I'm tired of the shit hand I'm dealt with and I'm going to deal with it. And this live action doesn't allow that. It's much more baked into evil and very clearly black and white evil.
Chalmers and Duero roll up. Chalmers was apparently hot on Udai's tail and was in fact trying to clear Jet's name by getting Udai to confess who he was working for. And by all of these characters getting wiped off the map, Jet can't have his name cleared and Chalmers can't help get him out of like the mess he's in. I appreciate what this moment does for Chalmers. I think it shows that he deep down is a good guy who's trying to do the right thing, at least sometimes. The problem is Jet's already served his time. If you make Jet this former Supermax inmate, and now he did his time and he's free, what does quote unquote clearing his name really accomplish?
I think it would have set Jet right because like, he's clearly burdened by the past of being labeled a dirty cop. It's baggage he didn't have in the anime. But what things get a little fuzzy for me is why didn't Chalmers tell Jet that his partner could be dirty? Like, why did he never actually set him up for this? And why does Chalmers let Jet off? That doesn't really add up in the ways that I would expect. Is it just because now he's a little bit more emotional about Jet because he's Kimmy's father? There's just so many whys and whats that this doesn't lead to a very satisfying conclusion for me.
No, I don't actually think he suspected Fad. I think he was after Udai and just thought Udai would make it clear what was going on. But to your point, like, I think you are asking rhetorical questions. And the fact that there are so many doesn't speak well for how this one buttons up. In true Netflix Cowboy Bebop tradition, that seems like it could have been the end of the episode, but it was not. We get a moment with Julia. And I actually kind of like how this scene is done. Julia puts together a bunch of micro pieces of evidence that had happened to her over the last couple of days. The kudo, Vicious's anger over Fearless, some amazing assassin killing Gunter. And she realizes Spike is alive. Fearless is alive. It's cut kind of fun. You know, her glass is dropping as all these flashbacks flood into her mind. And they play Adieu, this hit anime track that I love so much that is often affiliated with Julia in the original. And they play it and then stop playing it before it even gets into like the main body of the song. They stop it in a really weird place and don't let it play through the credits. I don't know if this is a question you know how to answer, Jamie, but I'm just wondering, is there some sort of legal difference between a song playing during the credits versus during the show that they were like, oh, turn it off? It's odd. Just odd.
Yeah, I don't know. I could have lived without this scene altogether. At this point, I had already put all the pieces and seeing her like go through this moment and hearing this track, it didn't hit me. I thought maybe it was beautifully shot. There was like a very nice aesthetic to it. But this was one of those tell moments to me. They didn't show me very well.
If I were to just go outside of the story and try to guess why they did this, I think it's a Netflix thing. I think it is you need a reason to let the show run and to binge and to have the next episode play. Because the Fad story was wrapped up. And this isn't how I feel. I would watch it regardless. But I think there's a motivation somewhere at Netflix, like we better have a cliffhanger at the end or some big realization that affects the next episode so people will keep watching.
Circling back to your ado question, now that I've thought about it a little bit more, it's possible that they cut it off because there's often the like play next episode button. And so if they needed to pay for more of the track, they didn't have to if they just cut it off there. Who would listen to it?
I mean, I watch the credits, but that's just because this podcast is my job. Attention all bounty hunters in the solar system. We have another awesome guest from the Netflix Cowboy Bebop with us today. Please welcome Anna Kavatha, the set decorator. It's so awesome to meet you. Hello.
Hi. Very happy to be here. Happy to be amongst Bebop fans. Very much.
And thank you for making the time. Please tell our listeners where you are joining us from today.
Well, I'm in a small town called Jeffreys Bay in South Africa. I just came from the middle of nowhere, riverbed. We're busy on a Disney feature at the moment. It's really taking me places. But I'm currently, we're recording this from a small town called Jeffreys Bay. Very famous for its waves, if you're a surfer.
I have never been, and it's something I've always wanted to try. So it's interesting to hear what you're working on now. Sounds like extremely busy project to project. For those at home who aren't necessarily in the business, what does a set decorator do? What's kind of a day in the life?
You know, people have asked me this question so many times, but there is no clear answer because every day is vastly different. The set decorator works closely with the production designer in terms of bringing the visual story to life. We're like interior, exterior architects. I can't really explain a day in the life because, I mean, on Friday, I was manhandling an excavator on truck mats, digging holes on a field. You know, it's like it's really different. And then other days, I'm in very fine design shops looking for, you know, Timothy Alton lights. And then other days, I'm up on a ladder trying to like manhandle drapes. It's very different. It's very creative. It's very busy. But yeah, the interior, exterior architects. When we play a vital role with the production designer for the visuals. So everything that you see visually, besides costume and VFX, will be us.
That sounds like a very particularly challenging line of work. It sounds like it requires certain, I would say, energies or personalities to really enjoy that work. So what attracted you to this field?
I studied film and then I was asked by a friend to come help during commercial season. And I really liked it. I liked the pace. I liked that it was creative. You had to think on your feet. I'm a film student. And obviously, film has inspired most of my childhood and my youth and my, you know, adolescence and, you know, still inspires me today. And it was very interesting to become aware of the intellectual thought that goes behind visual storytelling. Like, how do you actually convey a story without saying a word? And that's what we do. So I was very fascinated by that and then got involved with set decorating. And I've been a set decorator for 11 years. I was fortunate enough to work on a broad spectrum of films, but sci-fi is my jam. Like, you know, it's just I keep on going back to the genre of sci-fi because it's so challenging to create new worlds. And how do you do that? What do things look like? What do you remember? What is nostalgia? And how do you portray that visually through color and texture and set dressing? Well, I've established that sci-fi is my jam and I'm happy with that.
We saw that passion for sci-fi in your resume. You were on Mad Max Fury Road and Chappie and Resident Evil and Maze Runner. What do these jobs in terms of decorating the sets have in common? And how does a person become so competent at decorating and imagining these futuristic spaces?
Yeah, I mean, Mad Max was really good for me because we had to redefine every object. So a fork wasn't used as a fork, you know, it was used as a spanner. Like no object had the original meaning. So it was, Colin really pushed that a lot. Like, don't give me a fork to play as a fork. A fork needs to be like, because we're all scavenging for the objects that are still remaining on Earth. But, and also because everyone's a petrol head, how do you remake objects into something that can make a car run? Because it's all about the cars. It's not about, modern aesthetic or anything like that, which I really, really enjoyed. I was pushed beyond any creative boundary on Mad Max, and Maze Runner was so much different. I mean, Colin Gibson was our designer on Mad Max, and Daniel Doris was our production designer on Maze Runner, and he is phenomenal. Going from Mad Max's utopian wasteland to this extreme, clean, wicked lab, you know, that was built. And, you know, every world's different and you have to make it different. But the only way that you're going to keep up, in my opinion, with sci-fi is if you change with the technology. Like, you know, you go from, you need to know your difference in, you know, LED lights and how to make with CNC machines and sculpt out of high-grade poly on CNC machines. What's the difference between a 5-axis and a 7-axis? And how you manufacture in better time. Well, I like to make the big stuff. We, on Bebop, all of the big elements, I put my hand up for. Everyone has a different approach on how to reinvent worlds. I like to incorporate the new technology. It's difficult. There's not a lot of women who do sci-fi, I think. You know, it used to be only a male domain. And they, I mean, I had terrible things said to me back in the day when I first started out. I mean, really stupid things. Like, they wanted to, you know, bring men into meetings to explain how to plant power poles. I mean, it's like really stupid stuff. And that made me even more like, oh my gosh, you know, I'll be the best at this. it was very much male domain. Women really, you know, went shop for the pretty fabrics and some nice lights. They didn't know about machinery or, you know, how to cut and how to retrofit, and couldn't really talk to DOPs about the difference between RGBWT and RGB. And, you know, I had a really good mentor as well called Rosemary Brandenburg. She did the Transformer movies and Jedi Skywalker, you know, it's the last Jedi. And she inspired me to no end as well, to be a female voice in sci-fi. Because it's difficult, you know. I mean, people look at you like you don't know what you're talking about. But you just need to get never back down, I guess.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I'm so encouraged to know that you're so passionate about your work, because during my many watch-throughs of this show so far, it's the subtle things in the sets that really catch my eye, that really bring the Bebop to life and this world to life. And we learned off mic that you are a fan of this anime and that you were excited about the opportunity. But then you told us a little bit more. Would you go on and explain your experience?
Well, when I got told about the project through Gary Mackay, we were working together on a project called The Luminaries. And he was like, have you heard about Bebop? And I was like, no, I haven't. And he was like, well, go check it out. And I went and checked it out and I was like, oh my goodness, what a beautiful, poetic, ethereal, like the best anime I've ever seen in my life. And then he said to me, do you want to meet Grant Major? Because they were going to share the production design hat. And Grant Major is the best production designer, 2-time Oscar winner. And I was like, of course I want to meet Grant Major. Just to shake his hand, never thought I'd get the job. And then I got the job and then I really freaked out. I was like, I had a coming to Jesus moment going like, this is no, I can't do this. We'll never be that good. It's going to be, how do we do this? It's so big. The Bebop's like 40 meters by 15 meters. It's, I can't do this. And then I went to Gary and I was like, I don't think I can do this. I mean, I'm so sorry to have like put everyone through this turmoil. And, you know, now you think that I'm going to do this job, but I don't think I'm going to do this job. And Gary just laughed at me and he was like, no, you're going to do this job. You're going to do it. And I was like, okay, cool. We're going to do this job. And the one thing, you know, I really wanted to put, like, for the Bebop, we researched a lot of background stories. And the Bebop, for instance, is based on an old shipping trawler, right? So the first thing I had my dressers do is find me an old shipping trawler to buy. Like, they had to find me a big-ass ship, like a trawler, and I wanted to buy it. And we had no money. And I was like, I don't care. There's going to be a shipping trawler that someone's going to sell for no money. And we are going to like own that trawler. And true as fuck, there was a shipping trawler up for sale in Tauranga for like $70,000. It was cheap. And I sent the guys up there in a truck with blue overalls and blow torches. And we stripped that trawler. that guy didn't think that we were going to take so much, but we took like operating mechanisms, the pipes, the buttons, the lights, like cooling mechanisms. We stripped that trawler. We stripped it. And I mean, several trucks and all that pipe work, control panels, lights is inside the Bebop. And that number of the trawler that we stripped was actually embroidered onto the towels and stenciled onto the Bebop, the back number of the original trawler that we stripped. I mean, the Bebop is the love of my life, that's it. Like, it was literally, like, you couldn't touch anything on the set if I was there, because you would be, I don't want anyone touching the ship, or, you know, I was very precious about that ship. Very precious about the trip. But that's just like one little detail in the Bebop, and there's so much more. Like, you know, Jet's overall, the crow is on the front of the bridge. That whole bridge unit we built and retrofitted, all the buttons were working individually wired. There's all these Charlie Parker stickers on the dash that nobody even saw. But he was constantly in his jazz zone. He was constantly surrounded by Charlie Parker. All the little Easter eggs of the original anime was in that bridge. We had the little Sippy bird as well on the bridge, which was a reference to Alien, because we really was inspired about aliens and the ship in Aliens as well. So there's like subtle details. I mean, I found a vinyl record that was blue and had the red rose on it, and I almost died. I found this vinyl in a vinyl shop, and I was like, oh my God. Oh my God. It's like, it's the Bebop gods just like sent us these little gifts, and all of it was put in inside the Bebop ship.
I'm so excited to hear all these great things. As someone who's such a diehard anime fan, I thought I was going to give the Bebop the biggest grief when I was watching the live action, but I immediately glommed onto it. I thought it was one of the best expressions of the show, and having the open floor plan actually really allowed our characters to tell their stories more effectively. And it feels very lived in. Even those initial shots of the yellow couch, man, that really got me hyped. So thank you so much for that effort.
The thing is with the Bebop, our biggest challenge with the Bebop was because it was so big. So it was 40 meters across and 50 meters wide, and it was 4.5 meters high. So everything inside was going to look tiny, was going to look so small. So we had to make everything. So the couch was a 3-seater couch, but then it was put on top of a base to make it look bigger. The fan blades were made bigger so that it doesn't just disappear. The mold, the light was taken exactly off the anime, made and molded bigger. So the other couch, the yellow couch, was oversized. But if we didn't make it oversized, it would look so tiny in that big spaceship. But the spaceship is a trawler. It's a massive trawler. We can only go that far until it looked completely cartoonish. So everything was made. I mean, that couch was bought, reupholstered, ribbed, put on a base, lights inserted into it. I mean, it's like and that's just the couch. Never mind what was on the bridge or in the kitchen. We stripped an old restaurant that went bust, and we just took all their catering equipment, stripped it to make it lighter, fitted it inside. So it's all very used and broken kitchen equipment. But it was also Bebop. Bebop's like barely hanging on. It's like one switch away or one bump away from like literally falling apart. Jade's a cop. He's not actually a mechanic, but he thinks he is. So Bebop, there was shit everywhere, and he's going to fix this. And then he leaves notes. I had all these notes in the kitchen for Spike. Spike, please don't switch off. Don't switch this off. It trips the mains. You know, I've told you this. He has these little post-it notes for Spike not to touch anything, because the Bebop's barely hanging on. And I really wanted to tell that story that it's his ship and it's his house, because he's this drifter that lost his family. And Spike and Faye are like the strays that he picks it up. But Spike, for us, Spike, I didn't want to put anything in Spike's quarters, because Spike arrived there with his blue suit and he didn't want a history and he didn't want a future. So how do you tell that in dressing? How do you say, hey, look at this guy. Where's his shit? There's nothing there. He doesn't have any books. He doesn't have anything that is Spike. He doesn't have more than one suit. He doesn't have a nice duffel bag. He has nothing. It's just him, his blue suit, and that's it. And we really, really wanted to put that through, because doesn't that make you wonder, when in Jet's chaos of he's just who he is. Here I am. Here's my bonsais. Here's my mess. Here's my jazz. Here's my ship. And then there's Spike in this very sparse, empty room. And immediately you should go like, who's this guy?
There's a joke in the fandom that Spike doesn't actually have a room because we never see it in the anime. And the video game corrects that. He actually gets a quarters because of it. But in fan fiction, they often just say it's a place for him to dump his clean or dirty laundry.
Yeah, pretty much. And where he can eat noodles.
You've named so many interesting objects, and this series has vinyl. This series has VHS tapes. Were there any guidelines that you had to work in that said, like, this is the time we're in? This is what is Bebop and what isn't. And as a follow-up, was there ever anything that you had to reject from the set and not use because of it?
Yeah. So one thing we didn't want is we didn't want sleek, sleek, modern sci-fi. So we wanted to firmly base it in nostalgia. Nostalgia for the show, nostalgia for the characters, and nostalgia for an era that is very recognizable. So we didn't want this modern, sleek, like almost Passengers or Star Trek, like sci-fi. So we established that from the get-go. And I didn't want anything that screams, you know, slick and shiny and new and high tech. All our stuff, we would retrofit and build a lot of it and just put screens in. So a lot of the stuff on the bridge and a lot of the stuff in the monitor room. The monitor room's main deck was based off an old editing, 1917s editing table that we just put screens in. It was all made because the stuff that my buyers presented to me was rejected because it wasn't old enough or retro enough. So a lot of it we ended up like CNC cutting and making. Funny enough, we searched high and low for these editing tables. And just before the show finished, we found one on auction for $700 and we bought it to be showcased in season two because we were so hoping that there was going to be a season two. But yeah, a lot of the tech, because we were so specific about the world and what it needed to look like, we ended up making a lot more than just buying off the shelf. Because what we looked for wasn't on the shelf. It just wasn't. The reel-to-reel machines in the Londo Center was made. The TVs were made. There were these Ernest Ingle desks that we had in the Londo Center. They were like they're $25,000 a piece. And obviously, we don't have that money. We don't. So we made them out of this. It's a plastic board called Saluka. It's made and baked, and it's completely fake. And it looks exactly like the real thing. And we made it for like $6,000. You have to work all the angles because obviously I'm also responsible for a budget, but you want the look. So you just have to be real clever about it. But yeah, we were very specific about what it needs to look like. You know, I mean, a lot of the reviews were like, you know, where are we? Like, why does it look like that? And it looks like that because it's based in nostalgia and it's based in retro. Most of the time I was like, oh, so you see that it's different. It's supposed to be different. The original anime almost had no dressing in it. It was very sparse. The Bebop almost had nothing in it. And we just wanted to build on top of that existing layer and tell a little bit more of a broader tale, like I've just explained, the subtle differences between Jet and Spike.
So tell us about some of the teams you had to work with. I don't think anyone could have pulled this off alone. So what was the collaborative process like?
Oh my gosh, no, absolutely not. 10 episodes of full on like world building and there's like 10 signature sets in an episode. Oh no, I give full credit to my New Zealand team. Full credit. I had, at the time we were doing Bebop, we were competing in New Zealand against Lord of the Rings and Sweet Tooth. There was no crew. So my team was... This was the biggest show that they've done, most of them. This was the by far the biggest show that I've pushed them into positions they've never had to do before. Like Amy Holofield, she became our lead hand. Holly McPherson became key dresser, fabricator, like extraordinaire. I'm complete and utter awe of what they pulled off, seeing that this was the biggest show that most of them have ever done. And we were the smallest crew competing against, you know, big shows, but also for resources in New Zealand. New Zealand's population is 5 million. And so we were all scrambling for supplies and materials and, you know, sourcing. And I think my team fucking smashed it out of the water, They delivered. And it wasn't small sets. You know, you've got your bebop, then you've got throne room, then you've got Anna's bar. Anna's bar was like also 40 meters by 25 and in sections. And then we've got a backlot that we keep on rebuilding. It was massive. And if it wasn't for my team, I would have had a mental breakdown. They were they were phenomenal. Oh my gosh. That's why no one's leaving the Bounty Hunter group, because we've been to war together and now we're just going to like be friends and family for the rest of our lives. It's like, you know.
That sounds like such a wild experience all around for the 2 years or so that you all worked together. And I super appreciate you going into detail on these things. I think you're right when you say, like, really the viewers have no real clear understanding, because it really takes someone with your knowledge and your experience to demonstrate what goes into an effort of this production level. So you spoke earlier about how physical objects can tell the story for us, like they are very powerful things. And so did anything get imagined early on that you maybe you didn't have access to and couldn't build and got swapped out that you wish had stuck around?
For me, during the when we got stuck in the pandemic, there's obviously stuff that you wanted that you couldn't get anymore. So we couldn't, you know, it was non-existent on the shelf. And because of time, you had to compromise. You had to compromise. For instance, in Anna's bar, you know, it's the booths and the materials, because we had so much booths to upholster and make, and we had to settle for the material that was available. Which were, for me, was a little bit too soft. It's little things, but it's like, you know, what do you do? What do you do when you're stuck with what you have? You can only make, because nothing's available off the shelf. In a small room, like I said, New Zealand again is a country of 5 million. There's little stuff like that, that you feel that you compromised on. But then when it's not like I'm not happy with any of the sets. I think we did phenomenal on any of the sets. I don't know. You obviously saw Anna's bar, right?
I want to have a drink there. I think it's lovely.
You know that chandelier on top of the bar? It's made out of cotton on water bottles.
What? Wow.
So by the way, so what do you do when you can't find or buy or import a chandelier that's basically 4 meters or to 5 meters in length? You go and you buy pink cotton on water bottles and you put an LED light through them.
Wow.
So just like FYI, you know?
FYI. I love that. Amazing. You're so fond of the bebop, and the bebop is Jet's home. It became home to a lot of these characters. Was there any specific piece of set dressing or object that maybe the cast members got really attached to?
Yeah, I want to just say about the cast members, right? I've got so much respect for John. He walked onto our sets, and especially TJ, and he was like, this is the best set. He announced it on the PA system that this is the best set he's ever been on. And this is a guy coming from Star Trek, you know? And he was just so lovely. So was Mustafa. So was Danella. They were just absolutely appreciative. We got sent a message from John last night to all the bebop crew, and I just wanted to cry. Man, we loved the show and we loved working with each other. And we're sad. You didn't even see Radical Ed's story progress. But anyway, moving on. John had what we put in for Spike, besides some bell peppers in the fridge, was he had his Wing Chun, but that's what he would train on. But what we did is we gave it an ashtray, so he would be like training and smoking a cigarette.
Oh my goodness!
So we would be which we thought was so bebop. So he had his martial arts diamond looking all pro, and then an ashtray attached onto it for where he puts out his cigarettes while he's like smoking. So that was very Spike. For Mustafa, obviously, we created a little jazz section for him where he sits. He had this like velvet blue couch and this Bang & Olufsen vinyl player and all the jazz records. Charlie Parker was one of them, obviously. Otis Redding, we had all these jazz albums cleared. And that's where he sat, and he would prune his bonsais in that little area. The bonsai room was in another room, but he would sit there listening to jazz, pruning his bonsais. Faye came in much later. And what we did in the bathroom is that we just added way more like shelving for her in the bathroom because she loves the shower bath shower thing. So she kind of like, everyone owned a small section of the bebop where Jed had his jazz section. So Spike has his section where he did like his workout while smoking a cigarette. And Faye kind of like, she took over the bathroom. So, so that's kind of like how we made the divided the bebop up for them.
What about you personally? I don't know if this is something that's like allowed, but did you keep anything from this world?
No, nothing. No, I didn't. Because I thought we were going to be back. You know, Lupin? Lupin was one of the characters that Cowboy Bebop was based on. I found this little anime figure of Lupin and I put it in the drawer of the bonsai room as a little, no one knew it was there. I knew it was there. So maybe I'll keep Lupin. I'll ask Amy to keep looping for me. And also the thought of people like taking down the bebop is just, I can't deal. At one stage, they were talking about flatbacking the bebop to take it to the States after John Tory's ACL. You know, there was just like, you know, people were just swinging stuff around. And I was like, you know, when someone's cutting down a tree and you stand in front of them, you know, I was that person standing in front of the bebop going like, you can't flatback the bebop, she'll break. She'll break. She's not built to be flat back. She'd break. And then they didn't touch the bebop. They waited for me to leave the country before anyone went into the bebop to like even take off some motors.
Because if you were anywhere in New Zealand, you would have heard it. You would have felt it.
Yes, I would have been running with my, you know, Faye knives. defending my ship.
So I have a new question for you, and I'm really curious because it was a very prominent element in Binary Two-Step. It's a specific piece of the set, and it looks like a reactor. It's in the center of the living room, and it's got some very specific writing on it. It's a very big, chunky piece of mechanics. And you said you like doing the big pieces.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering what that element is. It's like in the back by the stairs, behind the couch, I think. Yeah. And it looks like an engine piece or some kind of main equipment.
It is an engine piece. Yeah, we did that. Yeah, Siddiq did that. Oh, it's a beautiful piece. It's basically what, it's like a prop shaft.
Yeah.
That's what it was based on. Yeah. Absolutely, we built that. Yeah, 100%. So it's what it's supposed to signify is it goes through all the levels down to the engine room. So it's a prop shaft that just submits power.
Oh.
The power gets generated from the engine room and gets driven up this prop shaft through all the levels. So from the engine room to the main cabin, to the crew cabins, you know, to the top, yeah. So it's like basically like a prop shaft that internally turns and creates and generates power.
That's so cool. And I'm glad we had this opportunity to ask you directly because I would have been wondering for years.
You're so nerdy, Jamie. So if it's not a season two, which we're all devastated by, what is next for you that you're able to talk about?
I actually got sent a script yesterday that is very interesting, also sci-fi. I'm not allowed, it's for Miramax, it's a feature. I'm not really allowed to talk about it at all. And then there was another one that sent me two scripts at the same time. One is for Miramax, obviously. It's a very interesting sci-fi. They told me it's art house, so just I had to keep it in mind. And then there was another one that's also a remake of an anime that I don't want to talk about either. And I don't know if I want to do it because Bebop broke my heart. broke my heart. So, but I'll read the script. I'll read the script, but I'm also, I can't really say much about it yet, but I've got those two options on the table at the moment. And I'm also just finishing off this Disney feature. But I would love to obviously get the Bebop family together on another show. They're my favorite family. The cast, the crew, the creatives. I loved working with Gary McKay. He's like my ride or die. Again, for a woman working in sci-fi, it's nice to have a man look at you in the eye and treat you as 100% equal and just gives you creative rein and let you run with it. It was the best experience. I will forever be grateful for that.
It was such a pleasure to speak with you today, Annika. Where can our listeners find you and how would we stay in touch?
I have a website. It's annikabota.com. It's just got, you can get hold of me there because I had some beautiful emails sent my way. One was from a high school student somewhere in the States saying that he's watched Cowboy Bebop and he's now completely convinced he's going to become a set decorator. And how can I help him fulfill his dreams? I was like, buddy, I love you. Number one, I love you. And I was like, this is what I did. I recommend you this, definitely study some like design or, don't just go work in the film industry. They'll take full advantage of you. And so that was beautiful. And then I had another email from a man saying that he saw one of the props and his girlfriend is so in love with this prop. And I told him exactly, like, I'm sorry, it's in our storeroom. The chances of you getting it out from our storeroom is highly unlikely. And we got it from a vintage shop. So I love these little emails. And I always respond to them because I know what it's like when, people don't respond to you. So I've had a couple of these very interesting emails and people reaching out and saying how much they love the design of the show and it's inspired them. So I have a website. It's annikabota.com. Feel free. I will happily answer any questions that I've missed. I'm just that type of person. It will take a while, as you know, it will take a while, but I will get there and will respond.
Well, we're so glad we got to stay connected to you and that you said yes to us. It's just been a tremendous privilege getting to know you today. Thank you so much for this interview.
Thank you for the opportunity, really, to talk about the Bebop. I'm still not 100% ready to talk about the Bebop, but yes, this helped a lot.
Thank you so much for tuning in this week. Join us next week as we discuss the live-action tie-in novel, Cowboy Bebop, A Syndicate Story, Red Planet Requiem with Sean Cummings.
Thank you for listening to the Bebop Beat. If you like our show, please rate us on Apple or wherever you find your podcasts. Find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bebop Beat. Our email address is bebopbeatpodcast@gmail.com.
The Bebop Beat is hosted and produced by Jamie Sanchez and Lauren Fates. Our editor and associate producer is Angela Geis. Our logo and art assets are by Kat Janda.